I don't particularly feel like an American right now, and I don't say that to be anti-American, but I just feel like I'm part of this community of victims. You know, we're all in this together, and it doesn't really matter if you're down here who's dropping the bombs, because you're still down here and you're still dying.
The uncle told me that we feel that we have no life, that our life here does not exist, and so death does not seem like a bad option compared to the life we have.
If we do not pause to take a good look at what this administration is doing, I think we're headed for one of the most painful times in American history.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, September 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. troops killed 8 members of an Iraqi police force today in a so-called friendly fire incident, sure to inflame anti-American sentiment already fueling a deadly guerrilla campaign. Police officer Assam Mohammed told Reuters News a joint force of the Iraqi police and the U.S.-backed security force of Fallujah were chasing thieves in a car shortly after midnight when U.S. soldiers opened fire, mistaking them for guerrillas. There was no immediate comment from the U.S. military. We were chasing a car when the Americans fired at us, Mohammed, who was wounded in the incident, said from his hospital bed. They continued firing for about an hour despite our pleas for them to stop and to tell them we are police and security, he said. Other police officers confirmed Mohammed's report and put the toll at 8 dead guards and 3 thieves. At least 6 police and guards were also wounded. In a separate incident in Ramadi, in the heartland of resistance to the occupation of Iraq, 2 U.S. soldiers were killed and another 7 wounded in a pre-dawn raid. The Israeli cabinet has voted to remove Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat from the Palestinian territory, calling him an obstacle to peace and warning that he should not sleep quietly and soundly at night. Shock and outrage from the world community has followed the announcement. The U.S. ambassador to Israel met today with senior Israeli leaders and redoubled the message from the White House that under no circumstances does the U.S. want anything to happen to Arafat at this point. Mitch Potter, correspondent for the Toronto Star in Jerusalem, spoke with Peace Watch today to discuss the reactions in the region and any possible political ramifications if Israel expels or assassinates the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat.
Well, I think chaos. I spoke to one senior diplomatic official in Ramallah today who told me that basically without Arafat, Israel is looking at Afghanistan on its doorstep. There's a sense here that if Arafat is expelled, and I think that's what most people are reading into this sort of ambiguous message from Israel, expulsion. I don't think anybody's anticipating that assassination is likely. But there's a sense that as long as Arafat is alive, no legitimate leader can arise from within the Palestinian camp. And so as we already know, there's an enormous amount of factional infighting. There's no clear line of succession after Arafat. Nobody has the legitimacy, and nobody will get the legitimacy to speak for the Palestinian people, as indeed nobody had it before Arafat arrived with the Oslo peace agreement 10 years ago.
Is there any legal basis under which Israel could possibly expel Arafat, the democratically elected president, from Palestine?
It's an excellent question. Not one that I'm aware of, but quite frankly, I'm not sure that legalities enter into the situation anymore. There's a feeling here that we've gotten past that, that Israel's been reminded again and again that it's in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention and many other statutes in international law and its handling of the Palestinians and the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, as indeed the militant extremists on the Palestinian side are in contravention of the concept of essential war crimes and the continuing barrage of suicide bombs. And of course, we had 2 more this week, one of them just down the street from me.
So legality has been basically tossed to the wind with regard to Israel, but perhaps not within the broader international community.
No, indeed, but at this point, I'm not sure that it's a factor. There's a sense that Israel has more or less painted itself into a rhetorical corner right now in its message from cabinet yesterday that it's prepared to remove Arafat. There are very few military options left for Israel at this point. There's not much that Israel can do with its army that it hasn't already done in an effort to stop the what they call the continuing terrorism from the Palestinian territories. So the options are few. Now, last Saturday, there was an attempt on Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who's the spiritual leader of Hamas. He survived with minor injuries, the Israeli assassination attempt. But the thought that he might be taken out, you have to understand, however the world might regard Hamas on a spiritual level, they regard Sheikh Yassin as the equivalent of the Pope. And there's a sense that a similar scenario might unfold if Arafat is removed, that it's a red line for Palestinians, a red line that would be breached completely, and it would mean that there is no restraint at that point. Mm. Already we believe that there are perhaps three or four Palestinian suicide bombers already inside Israel proper and ready to ignite should an additional step unfold. So I have to tell you, it's an incredibly depressing, tense precipice that we're upon here, and not very many of my colleagues expect that there are too many ways for this to get better in the short term. It's going to get worse.
When you say a red line, I'm almost afraid to ask what that means. Does that mean a bloodline?
I think so. I think journalists responded differently to the suicide bombings on Tuesday night. I went to the village of Rantis, which is where the two bombers arose. They came from this village about 36 kilometers north of Ramallah, and I sat there and I spoke to a lot of people in town, including the remaining family members. 20 of them overnight had been arrested by the Israeli military in an incursion into that village. It's a village that's isolated on three sides by Israeli military, as indeed is a large part of the West Bank. It's very difficult to get inside or outside. The people there speak of squalor and despair. They don't have adequate water supplies going to the village. They feel like prisoners. And the uncle of one of the two bombers, we don't know which bomber went to which destination at this point, but he quite possibly was the bomber that was just down the street from my home in a fairly trendy district called the German Colony, where people drinking lattes late on Tuesday night died, seven of them died on the spot, and about 50 were injured. The uncle told me that we feel that we have no life, that our life here does not exist, and so death does not seem like a bad option compared to the life we have. He said that we have no F-16s, we have no helicopters, all we can do is present our souls as martyrs. And by martyrs, they mean suicide bombers. When I talk about a red line, I think the fear that there will be a wave of suicide bombs like we've never seen before, I think is a very real possibility.
You say, however, that the Israeli military has painted themselves into a corner and they have few military options. Yet we saw yesterday where the military surrounded Arafat's compound prior to the vote that the cabinet took, and you say that you doubt that there will be an assassination attempt on Arafat's life. What do you suspect will happen or might happen?
Well, there are different analytical reads on what's happening right now. I think that you have to, it's important to point out that even as these events are unfolding, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is sliding in the polls. His approval rating is falling. And I don't think it's exclusively because of what Israelis call the security situation, the conflict with Palestinians, but that's a huge part of it. He's personally implicated in a potential corruption scandal right now that may or may not become a heavier weight on his shoulders as time unfolds. But in addition to that, the economy, as we all know, is completely devastated in Israel, as indeed it is in the Palestinian territories. And all the while, since he became prime minister and indeed was reelected last spring, Sharon, the great warrior of Israel, has been promising that there is a solution, that they will find a way to end terrorism. And the public has given him enormous leeway and enormous faith in that, and it is not working. It has not worked for the Israeli military, It has not worked for the Israeli security strategists. So this is what I mean by running out of options. There doesn't appear to be a great deal left to do. Some analysts are saying that the IDF, in enormous, unprecedented numbers, perhaps as many as 60,000 troops, would have to be mustered to reinvade the Gaza Strip to completely uproot any kind of resistance and to send such a powerful message, a brutal message, in fact, that it would completely put down any possibility of continuing Palestinian resistance. Now, they already did that in the West Bank last spring in a process called Operation Defensive Shield, again in the wake of a great many suicide bombs. The Gaza is the only place left to go in terms of a military action. It's either that or go after a leader. Now, I can't rule out that there will be an assassination on Arafat, but my diplomatic sources tell me that there's a real schism going on in the Israeli leadership. It's a dynamic perhaps not unlike what's happening in the United States right now, wherein you have the State Department in the United States sending one message, along with the CIA, to the American leadership about the plight in Iraq, sending a message that some of the events happening are not in America's best interest. And the inner sanctum of the White House does not want to hear that message and is repelling it. And in Israel, a similar dynamic is happening where the head of the Mossad and the head of the Shin Bet, these are Israel security services, together with the foreign ministry, is saying it's a disaster to go after Arafat. You know, the genie will be let out of the bottle in ways we can't predict. But the inner core of Sharon's regime, including the right-wing cabinet ministers and the head of the army intelligence, are prepared to repel that information at this point. And that's why they took the decision they did last night in a vote of 10, 4, and 1 against. There was one vote against in cabinet for the decision to remove Arafat.
Who was
and
that?
Of course, Israel reserves the right to decide when and where that will happen.
And who was the one against?
Abraham Porras, who's a more a centrist minister than the rest. And I think he's swayed by the argument of the Mossad intelligence chief. The fear, of course, is that Arafat may well be gone from the Palestinian landscape, but he will be then unleashed on the world stage to do whatever damage he might to Israel's cause by being welcomed as an exiled head of state on the stage of the world.
We also saw yesterday where tens of thousands, did they not, came out in support to rally around Arafat once the announcement was made. Tell us exactly what happened, please.
That's such an enormous irony. When you look, even 1 year ago, the Palestinian public was extremely disenchanted with Arafat. And, you know, they'd struggled long and hard in a brutal intifada that was in its second year and showing no sign of gaining them anything whatsoever. They'd had loss of income, loss of their livelihoods, and no sense that anything was to be shown for it. So people were making jokes about Arafat in the street. They were ridiculing him as a man who had lost touch. And yet, you know, I keep coming back to this because it's such a remarkable dynamic in the Palestinian society. There is such a complex love-hate relationship that Palestinians have with Arafat. They may hate them on many levels, but he is their leader to hate. And when the outside world intervenes, they rally to his side. I had one of the most outspoken critics of Arafat, and, you know, let's not kid ourselves. This is basically a tin pot dictatorship we're talking about. They're trying to create democratic institutions on the Palestinian side, but boy, do they have a long way to go. Arafat does not tolerate dissent and hasn't historically since he arrived 10 years ago with the Oslo process. But one of his most outspoken critics compared the Palestinian Authority leadership to Animal Farm and said that Arafat is the pig, and went on and on in an interview I conducted last summer about the corruption that is inherent, absolutely inherent in that leadership. And yet he said, if you cut open my vein and you take a drop of my blood out and you put it on a microscope and get right into the DNA, you will see a tiny little Yasser Arafat inside every cell, because he is such a symbol, a 36-year symbol. He essentially invented the Palestinian leadership, the Palestinian cause. And so on a symbolic level, when the outside world wants to move him, it just strikes at the absolute core of what it means to be Palestinian. And even holding their nose, they will rally to his side.
So if the spiritual Hamas sheikh is compared to the Pope, who is Arafat?
He's Che Guevara and Osama bin Laden wrapped in one. I don't know. But there is a fight for freedom happening for Palestinians, and he embodies that fight so much more so than any other single living person. Perhaps the way to read it is, you know, Israel's line on it is he's part of the problem, not part of the solution, therefore he has to go. And, you know, I think that pragmatists look at the situation and they say, well, you know, he is part of the problem, but he also is the solution and perhaps the only solution. Until he dies a natural death, you cannot deal with the Palestinians without coming to the door of Yasser Arafat.
Mitch Potter, thank you so very much for your time and perspective. Are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
There is nobody that has spent time in this theater of conflict who believes that there is anybody on the planet that can do anything about this conflict other than George Bush. Israel, in many ways, is holding back from acting on Arafat because of the message from the U.S. Leadership. What George Bush says goes with Israel. Now, you've got the Palestinians crying out for international intervention. They would welcome any kind of intervention that would separate the Israelis and the Palestinians on the ground. Israel has always been reluctant to accept any kind of solution that would involve outside troops on the ground. But if ever there was a conflict that cried out for peacemakers on the ground, this is it. And the only one that can deliver that is George Bush.
Mitch Potter is a correspondent for the Toronto Star in Jerusalem. An Amnesty International spokesperson says for Israel to deport Arafat would violate international humanitarian laws, which prohibits the forcible transfer and deportation of protected persons from occupied territories. British Prime Minister Tony Blair's determination to take Britain to war against Iraq has again left the Prime Minister politically exposed. After it emerged, he had been warned a month before the start of the war that it could heighten the international terrorist threat. But Blair chose to disregard this warning, and the information was kept from the public and MPs ahead of their bitterly contested vote to endorse military action. As Parliament's watchdog of the intelligence services published its report into the information received by the government on Iraq, the attention of most journalists was initially focused on what the document might say about Jeff Hoon, the defense secretary. But the spotlight was soon back on Blair after it emerged that the prime minister had received a report from the Joint Intelligence Committee in February, warning that the invasion of Iraq could heighten the threat from al-Qaeda. At the start of this year, there were repeated rumors that senior intelligence officials were expressing concerns that an Iraq invasion could hinder the war against terror. But the fact that this argument had been made by the JIC, the body that collates all intelligence information, was unknown until its disclosure by Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee. Blair's cabinet might well have been aware that the JIC had delivered the warning in a February 10th document entitled International Terrorism, War with Iraq. Most of Blair's cabinet was briefed privately by John Scarlett, the JIC chairman, after February 10th. It was revealed. A lot of people have tried to interpret the meaning of the terrorist attacks that occurred 2 years ago this week, and they've tried to answer the recurring question, why do they hate us? Others ask why the U.S. has stepped so quickly into a revenge mode, fueled by what they perceive as a blinding patriotic fever. Among those who've weighed in on these issues is musician and longtime activist Harry Belafonte. He spoke last year with Corey Dubin of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles on the one-year anniversary of the terrorist attacks.
Why do we need to profess our love of country and our commitment to our constitutional gifts by rattling the sabers of war and demonstrating to ourselves and to the world that we are invincible, that we are omnipotent, that we will prevail over all, and we will do anything within our power and our means to sustain that platform for eternity? I think that we have really and truly come to a place where if we do not pause to take a good look at what this administration is doing and all those who support the policy of the present administration, I think we're headed for one of the most difficult and one of the most painful times in American history. It's not too unlike another time in mankind's history when this was done to our neighbors and to our friends, and I'm referring to the time of the Second World War and the great rise of fascism and what Hitler and his hordes did to the peoples of Europe. Those who perpetuate this kind of behavior, or these kinds of behavior, are men who have learned from history themselves and have come to find a glossary, a slick way in which to be able to feed all this, so that in the final analysis, we'll wake up one day and our civil liberties will be gone, our freedoms will have been thoroughly crushed, we'll have participated in the organizing of a villainy beyond which we will not be able to retrieve ourselves anytime soon.
Harry, with all your travels around the world, around the globe for so many years, do you have any perception on why the one question that seems most important isn't being asked, which is why?
Because the dialogue that the nation and the world would love to get into is the dialogue that those who oppose us do not want to get into. Our fear is the best instrument for villainy. And we must sustain that capacity for feeling fear and for responding to fear in order to be able to ram through the suspension of our Bill of Rights, to have our telephones tapped, to have surveillance going on everywhere, for our neighbors to call in and to spy on us and to report us to the authorities for whatever the whim they may find at their disposal to do their mischief. We do not want to get into that. Because to get into that is to have to answer questions that will awaken a lethargic public and perhaps turn people into an active mass, into an active force that would draw the line and say, we will not step over this boundary. Every time we have been told the truth about whatever it is that goes on in the world, invariably the American people seizes the high ground and takes the moral position, the correct moral position, in dealing with any such villainy. We did it in the Second World War. We did it when we were conflicted about what we were doing in Vietnam. We did it when we were told the truth about what was happening to the black citizens of this country during the civil rights struggle. People rose up and rebelled against what McCarthyism did to other citizens when people got to know the truth. The problem is, when does the public get to know the truth, and will they know it too late?
Given what you've said, give our listeners a feel for what you think they should reflect on today in memory of those who passed and this day.
On the morning of 9/11, I had just come off doing a broadcast for the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, and I was on my way down to the World Trade Center. As I stepped off the broadcast and looked at the screen, I saw the planes entering the building, and at first I thought it was a commercial for a new film, some Hollywood fantasy, only to discover, like everyone else did, that that this wasn't in case reality, and the horror of it overwhelmed me, as it did everyone else. One of the things that I did, as I always do when I get into places such as this, not with great regularity, but enough for one to take note, I turned to the wisdom of others. And Dr. Martin Luther King, whom I served and who was a friend, always becomes a great source for me to help me muddle through questions that rise up for which we seem to have no answer. And then turning to Dr. King's writings, I found a passage that had to do with terror. It was the terror that black people were feeling at the time in Birmingham, Alabama. The church had been bombed, the children were murdered, and others were being set upon by the Ku Klux Klan and by an unjust system protected by law to heap animosity on the black citizens of the South. And when the church was bombed and Dr. King looked at all this rage that was around and saw the anger that existed in us, he said, let us pause in this moment of our anguish and reflect on what is happening. We must ask ourselves, why are we so hated? Why are we so disliked? And if we honestly pursue the investigation of that question, and we conclude that we have played a role in this anguish and have played a role in this villainy, do we have the courage to admit it, and do we have the will to fix it? Will we make a difference? I travel around the world because that's the work I do. I work for the United Nations. I serve an organization called UNICEF. I became a partner in the work of UNICEF back in 1986, right after artists from America put together a remarkable cultural event called We Are the World. And we sang a song that awakened global consciousness to what was going on in the great famine in Africa that had taken millions of lives in its wake. When I joined up with UNICEF, I became focused on the plight of children. And this took me all over the world, to Asia, to Africa, to Central America, to Latin America, and through many parts of the United States. And in this, I saw what happened to children in governments that did not have to answer to anyone, that were not held accountable, governments that were not democratic, governments, many of whom we supported, many of whom we put into positions of power. We watched our institutions that exploit the cheap labor market, as we so hungrily admit that we do, looking for better prices for the production of goods, really means that we are crushing the lives of other people. We're taking away the rights of other citizens in order to feed our hedonistic pleasures, to feed that which is so central to our culture that it smothers all honest thought, and that is greed. It has overrun us. Dr. King said, we must take a look at the role we play in this villainy before we can bring solution and resolve to the villainy. I do not suggest that bin Laden and terrorists who have come to that extreme should be tolerated or accommodated in any sense of the word. So let me hasten to put that on the table. But you must look at the trough from which the bin Ladens of the world feed, how they sustain themselves. Who are the wretched of the earth? And how did they become so wretched that these men could amass such villainy to oppose us and to defile us and to bring their rage at our doorsteps and to so confuse the American people? Because we sit somewhere in the illusion that we are all pure, all good, and that we give the world so much, how could the world turn around and so cruelly hurt us and try to destroy our way of life? In fact, we're asking the wrong question. Because, you know, I watched the broadcast the other day and they said, we must be vigilant, as the president says, against tyranny. Because these people, they hate us because we are free. They hate us because we speak freely. They hate us because we are a democracy. They hate us because we are free to worship the way we want. That is a rather cynical and I think a rather misleading point of view.
Musician and longtime activist Harry Belafonte speaking with Corey Dubin of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. He was interviewed last year on the one-year anniversary of the terrorist attacks.
Winter in America, and all of the healers done been killed. Sit away. Winter in America, and ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows, nobody knows.
Gil Scott-Heron with Brian Jackson, Winter in America. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.